What if the history of Islam in the West was not just a story of clashing cultures? Here's a true story from the 16th century, the age of Elizabeth I.
The story is an amazing story. It's about a working class man from Lancashire, Thomas Dalham. He makes mechanical, very rudimentary organs. Elizabeth hears him play this organ at court. She's so amazed by it that she says, I'd like to send it as a present to my friends in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. She sends it in 1599 with Dalham. He's on board a ship. He arrives in Istanbul. He unpacks it. The organ, it's been destroyed. He then puts it back together, wheels it into the great imperial palace, plays the mechanical organ. And the Sultan says, that's absolutely brilliant. You can stay here and you can convert to Islam. I'll give you as many of my women from the harem as you like. Mm-mm. No thanks, I'm going to go home. He's given a Turkish interpreter and guide. He then discovers that this Turkish guide and interpreter is actually a man born 10 miles away from his hometown in Lancashire, who has converted to Islam and is now a Turk. What did they talk about? They're just from a few miles apart. They probably know people in common. And here is one, a Protestant organ maker, and another, probably willingly converted to Islam. He speaks Turkish. And at some point, they separate. And one goes back to England, and one goes back to Turkey.
That's just one of the stories Jerry Broughton tells in The Sultan and the Queen. Jerry's a professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London, and he's uncovered a history that goes against everything we've been told about the relationship between Islam and the West. And it begins on the day in 1570 when a letter arrives at the English court, a letter from the East.
It arrives in a capsule, and it's written in very beautiful, high, honorific Turkish, to as it would look like Arabic, script. And it's a letter from the Sultan, Sultan Murad III, a letter that arrives and says, greetings to Elizabeth, the great princess of England, and starts this remarkable Anglo-Islamic alliance. They both exchange letters over the decades. Elizabeth becomes so close to Murad and his Ottoman Turkish royal family that she starts exchanging gifts with his mum. So I wanted it to open with this very beautiful account of the letters, the sophistication of the exchange, to say we should remember that there are moments where the West and the East, where Christianity and Islam has looked at each other as equal players and also exchanged and had a cordial relationship.
Well, it's also the beginning of a huge and lively trade between the two countries. What was coming into England from the Ottoman Empire?
Well, amazing things, because they want the silk that comes from Iran, the rugs and the carpets that also come from Ottoman territories, all the spices, the sugars, the great luxurious Oriental goods that we always think about in our imagination, these Orientalist fantasies. You know, the language changes. Suddenly you get words like candy, crimson, turquoise. These are all terms which have come from the Arabic, Ottoman, Persian tradition and enter the English language in the late 16th century. And it's there. It's hidden in plain view. You look at any Elizabethan Tudor portrait from this period. You look at what Elizabeth is wearing. It's all from the East. You know, it's silk, it's taffeta, it's Orient pearl. And we forget that it's come about because of this lively exchange that's gone on between the two cultures.
So this is a story that really has been left out of history books, this close alliance between a Christian queen and the ruler of the Ottoman Empire. And it went on for a long time. Put this in some context, because honestly, it seems like it wasn't that long since the Europeans, including the English, were taking part in crusades against the Muslim world.
It is a sea change because, of course, the English are to some extent involved in the Crusades hundreds of years earlier. And so then what you've got in the 16th century is a very different kind of moment, when the Christian church fragments, where Lutheran Protestantism emerges and takes on Catholicism, and England goes down the Protestant route. What then happens is that Catholicism, the papacy, says, well, that is a form of heresy. So what the English do is say, fine, if we're going to be called heretics, we will reach out to our enemy's enemy, who is in fact the Ottomans. But of course, we know this. We know how realpolitik works. We've known this for thousands of years, that that's how you do those political alliances.
Yes, it's so contemporary, but it also reminds us just how crafty and wily a stateswoman Elizabeth was. And this was not the young Elizabeth. This is the Elizabeth in later years, right?
Very good point. You know, I often think of Elizabethan England in this period. It's a bit like the Soviet bloc in the 1970s and 80s. There's a theological iron curtain that is isolating England. And so Elizabeth is trying to circumvent this, to reach out to the Islamic world to survive. And there's no doubt that without that support from the Islamic and particularly the Ottoman Empire, Elizabethan England may not have made it. You know, the Spanish and the papacy endlessly trying to invade. We know the Armada leaves in 1588 and fails. The Ottomans were possibly involved in that. The English were trying to split the fleet by getting the Ottomans involved to take on the Spanish in the Mediterranean. So it seems to me no question that without that support from the Islamic world, England itself, the place I'm now sitting in, may be very different. I may be speaking Spanish and going to a Catholic church.
Doesn't this seem like a remarkable thing to you to be saying today, when Western countries, yours and mine, see Muslims as a threat, and many people have suggested closing the borders even?
I mean, it has such resonance. So when I was writing the book, I was talking about these English men and some women traveling across places like Aleppo, Baghdad, Raqqa. I mean, these places which have such a tragic resonance for us today, this is not a clash of civilizations. The rhetoric that's currently being peddled in Europe and, of course, in the US about isolation, about separation, segregation, you know, we need to look at historical moments where that was not the case. And here is one. It is a surprising one. And of all people, it's with the iconic Queen Elizabeth I.
But wasn't there still a theological divide, a big theological divide between all these Protestant English people and Muslim Turks?
Well, there are, but what's also interesting is that many of the Englishmen who travel as far as Persia start to see a distinction between Sunni and Shia beliefs in Islam. And then you have these Englishmen saying, you know what, that conflict is not dissimilar to the Catholic Protestant one that's tearing Europe apart at the moment. And at the same time, I have stories of English men, and we believe also some women in the late 16th century, working and living in Islamic lands in the Mediterranean, who openly and freely convert to Islam.
Some of those are wonderful stories. Tell at least one of them.
I mean, there's an extraordinary story by a man who's called Samson Rowley. And Samson Rowley is a merchant from Norfolk in southeast England. And he travels into the Mediterranean in the 1570s. He's captured by Turkish pirates. He is, we believe, castrated. he is then converted to Islam. And the English ambassador to Istanbul writes to him in the 1580s, and he says, you are now no longer Samson Rowley. You are known as Hassan Aga, who is the chief eunuch and treasurer of Algiers, living in an opulent palace.
So now he's become part of the ruling Algerian elite.
He's become part of the Muslim ruling elite in Algeria. And the English merchants say to him, would you like to reconvert and go back to Norfolk? And he says, no, thank you. Why would I? And of course, it sounds quite funny. But at the time, you realize that there is not an absolute belief that English Protestantism will survive. And you look at this massively powerful, culturally sophisticated empire, which stretches from Morocco in the west to India in the east, and it's taking on the Spanish Empire and winning. And you think, whose side do you want to be on? And so again, we forget that belief. We think obviously there's a superiority to Christian belief. Nonsense. It's simply not the case. And it's not till much later that people think, yes, you know, there's going to be the great triumph and the rise of the British Empire. You know, I think the British Empire rises, the great Raj and the sun that never sets on the world, is partly because of this alliance with the Islamic world and the emulation of those imperial policies that the English see at work in the Ottomans.
That just seems like such a historical irony. I mean, it sounds like English imperialism was copied from the very cultures it later subjugated.
Well, I think that that's a really important point, because that's why the story has really been buried. And no surprise, because, of course, in the 19th century, this was a place where the Europeans were basically trying to conquer. There was the whole tradition of Orientalism, which said everywhere in the Middle East was, you know, dirty, despotic and backward. And it seems to me that's why these kind of stories about the East-West exchange that fluently went on in this period just got lost, didn't get told throughout the 19th and into the late 20th century. I myself just started working on it only rather spookily just before 9/11. And of course, the 7/7 bombings in London were perpetrated by young radical Muslims who were from my hometowns of Leeds and Bradford. So that, for me, you're right, you know, it has this incredible charge, it seems to me, about how you use historical stories today to try and reach out to tell a different story, and hopefully to reach out for some form of accommodation and to celebrate and hold on to the moments of plurality, of tolerance, of exchange, because they have been there, and therefore hopefully we can have them again.
Jerry Broughton is a professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London. His book is called The Sultan and the Queen.